Thank you very much. In the time allotted, I'm going to try to summarize a new discovery, or at least a new concept in core collapse supernova explosion theory. This is work in collaboration, and in particular with Luc Desart, Eli Livni, Christian Ott, Jeremiah Murphy. And what we've done is we've put together 2D radiation hydrocodes with positive aspects and negative aspects to simulate core collapse and the subsequent evolution. Other than the approximations that are employed, there are no free parameters in this, and we've explored a variety of progenitors. I'm going to present results on just a few progenitors. We have cooking and in the can a number of other models. And so the numbers that I'm going to present are not going to be definitive, of course, in the context of our calculations, but they'll just be representative. But I want to present the new ideas in as coherent and cogent a way as possible. And in so doing, the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to first provide words that you'll be able to read and listen to. I'm going to explain the basic mechanism and what the differences are. Then I'm going to show graphical stills that will compare, that will show the basics of the physics. And then I'll show movies of some of the results. And so all those things are connected. If you don't understand the beginning, you might start to understand the beginning and the end. And then I'll summarize with, I suppose, what I'll call a summary. So the basics is just here. And this is my view of the current status of the neutrino mechanism. The direct mechanism, which is spherically symmetric hydrodynamic mechanism, never works. The bounce shock doesn't work for reasons we can understand. A spherically symmetric neutrino mechanism might work, and there's some nice work done by Katara et al. For the lowest mass progenitors, although we have to have the right envelopes on these things, but they give under-energetic explosions. But they do seem to give explosions even in spherical symmetry. So when you have very tenuous outer envelopes in the progenitor cores, you might be able to get the neutrino mechanism to work. And I'll remind you, the shock stalls and then is revived again by neutrino heating in this context. It's also possible that that doesn't happen in some models, but that the 2D effects or multi-D effects can conspire with the neutrinos to actually give you, again, what seem to be under-energetic explosions and probably driven by the winds at the later times, but seem to be suggestive. And this is work in progress, but it's nice work by Burris et al. Accretion-induced collapse, where you have an oxygen-neomagnesium core in a binary that achieves the Chandrasekhar mass, quite easily explodes by the neutrino-driven wind mechanism. Just you get a wind off the surface, and I'll show a little bit of that from the work of Desart et al. My feeling is, and this is a prejudice, and people, of course, have been discussing this, that pulsar spins indicate, and a fair amount of physics indicates, that cores that collapse start slow. They're not rotating fast. And so I think that rotation is of secondary consideration in the garden variety supernova explosions. They may be central to hypernovae and gamma ray bursts. And of course, this is the subject of this conference, but not my talk. And so you ask, what is left? Well, there's something interesting that we think we've discovered. If the neutrino mechanism works, it generally will work early. And what I'm about to tell you won't work very well. The neutrino mechanism will abort this mechanism. So if it doesn't work, or when it doesn't work, then there's the potential for something new. You get neutrino-driven convection early on, but after about 200 milliseconds, shock instability, which you heard from Blondin and Janka earlier in the week, does manifest itself. And we see this instability after time in all the models, to varying degrees, with varying radii, etc. But it becomes fairly vigorous, and that can be explained, I believe, reasonably well by the work of Foglizzo, although there are modifications to the neutrino cooling and heating and the electron capture and putting in proper equation of state in initial model. But by and large, we do see this growth of this instability. The shock instability grows to nonlinear status, and at that stage, it by and large generates secondary shocks. They're nested shocks. There's more than one shock. And the shocks, of course, generate entropy, and that's one of the major reasons that the oscillations saturate. This is not the explosion. It does not work when you put in the proper neutrinos, etc., as far as we can see. But what it does is it sets up a situation that actually causes quite anisotropic accretion onto the inner regions. You start out with spherical accretion on the outside. It channels, it creates these funnels at the shock-shock interactions through which accretion occurs, dancing streams, matter accretion streams over the surface. You also generate significant amount of turbulence and increasing Mach number and entropies, and you can show under those circumstances that you start exciting core G modes. This SASI, so-called, the Sustained Accretion Shock Instability, has periods on the order of 25 to 30 milliseconds. That is not the relevant time scale for what I'm about to show you. The inner core has oscillation periods for the Newtonian calculations, and general relativity might be even more dramatic, of about 3 milliseconds. In fact, an order of magnitude lower. And what happens in these calculations is, in fact, that the core G modes are excited, stellar pulsation G modes in the cores, that are not L equals 0, of course. They're L equals 1, L equals 2. They're anisotropic oscillations. They're not radial pulsations at all. And those can be excited to fair amplitude, and they damp by the emission of sound. And what we think is a possible mechanism for explosion is the acoustic powering of the explosion, not by neutrinos, but by sound. And it'll be manifest throughout the rest of the presentation exactly what the character of this is. The sound that's generated is coming out in 3-millisecond pulses. It goes down the density gradient and steepens into shocks, and you deposit a fair amount of that acoustic power. There's also, associated with sound waves, momentum flux, and you don't have that to the same degree with neutrinos. Now, there's an important point here. The neutrinos have high power but low efficiency for coupling with matter. The sound has lower power but very high efficiency for coupling with matter, 100%. You're depositing in the baryons immediately. And you can ask the question, is that product of luminosity and efficiency for the neutrinos and sound, are they comparable? In the early phases, the neutrinos win. If they don't cause explosion, the sound actually takes over, and I'll show a plot of that. As I said, they steepen into shock waves, and you'll see that fairly dramatically in some of the presentations. We get an explosion. Now, this is a nominal time. We've carried out calculations, at least four of them, out to 1.5 seconds after bounce. It takes a fair amount of time. This is just an example of one that exploded early, and the major reason is it has a very low accretion rate on the outside. Well, it has a lower accretion rate on the outside. One curiosity in all this is that the sound is the source of the entropization of the matter. The explosion is actually very radiation dominated, and you produce entropies which we think are consonant with what's required for the R process at those timescales. And so we get simultaneous R process conditions, close to them, and explosions. And generally that has not been possible before. People haven't seen that before. Generally the core is a transducer. What you have is accretion power that excites the core that radiates sound. It's also a self-excited oscillator. I can try to go into that a little bit later, and you get significant oscillations. So when the core gets the significant amplitude, you have a lot of kinetic energy, a lot of pulsational energy. And if there's no other channel for that energy to go away, for example, gravitational radiation or neutrinos, which will be important, then acoustic power will just take that away. So the core oscillation is a capacitor, and you're just discharging the capacitor via sonic power into the nebula and blowing up the star. It's very different. Now, I'm not going to go through this. This is just if people want to know about the code, the Vulcan 2D that's been put together to do this. And we're using the multigroup flux limited diffusion flavor of this, because that's the only one we can really push to late times. It does the radio transfer in 2D. It's multigroup. We can do rotation. It has a nice Poisson solver. Everything is in 2D. The core can move. Which is very, very useful in this regard, but it doesn't do multi-angle transport. The code can do that, but that's much too slow, and we really want to improve what we can do before we push that further. And so this will start the summary set of graphs. A radius versus time, where this is 0.2 seconds after bounce, 0.4, 0.6, and the colors are entropy, but that gives you a nice indication of where the shock is. So here's 200 kilometers, 400 kilometers. There's bounce, the shock stalls, but it starts to rise up and then go down. And frequently people stop the calculations there because they were hoping that the shock would continue out, the neutrinos would do their job, but they don't. And so you can stop here. But you can see indications early, and then certainly an indication here of this vertical acoustic instability, the SASI. And this starts to grow quite significantly with periods of 30 milliseconds. And you can see you can get to 400 kilometers, 600 kilometers, and the thing still doesn't explode. You get very wild excursions, but it doesn't explode. Neutrino cooling, et cetera, and the generation of secondary shocks, which are indicated by the darkening coloring here, are at play. But this situation sets up the significant oscillation of the core. Without this, we don't get pumping of the inner modes. And it'll take a fairly long time to see this, but eventually the core starts to oscillate significantly. This is not the best way to see it, but you can actually see the oscillations in the interior here, and that generates an explosion. An explosion is always aspherical. The generic case is unipolar. It will explode more spherically later, but the early development is always in one direction. We get L equals 2 character as well, and that's going to be both directions, sort of, and exactly what the behavior is going to depend on 3D, is going to depend on better code, a number of things like that. It's a very chaotic process. So we're looking at the generic processes, the generic stages, and not expecting that the numbers in detail will be given. This is the same plot, but just on a different scale, just to show this particular explosion has got to 2,000 kilometers. This dark color is where all the entropy is. All this shock, all these sound waves seeping into shocks are giving this, filling this cavity, in fact, with acoustic power and high entropy that just blows out. It doesn't blow out immediately. It pushes its way out. And curiously, you continue to get accretion. In other types of explosion mechanisms, accretion has always been in the way. This is in the way too, but once it starts to explode, the material that's accreting is redirected to the other side, and you simultaneously get accretion and explosion. The accretion continues the powering of the core's oscillation, and it continues as long as we want. We get everything to explode in the Newtonian calculations. I think that things, of course, won't for the more massive cores, and that's going to be a daunting exercise to try to do right, particularly with general relativity. No, you're not, but go on.
The radiation, I mean, how do I regard radiation here from the incoming one? And I think of a physical light and motion.
Yeah, sound. It's a speaker. What do you mean? That is the radiation, but that power, that you're sending out sound waves. And they're steepening into shock waves, but even if they didn't, they're being absorbed by the outer shock, etc. You're just depositing that the energy in the matter. It's just acoustic power. When you say loss, the neutrinos can help early, we think, and it still may be the neutrino mechanism with better physics will obtain. That's not what we see, but that's possible. But the major power is the acoustic power that is whose fundamental source is gravitation, which is also the fundamental source for the neutrino. And so this is a plot of frequency versus time, nicely put together by Luc Desart, 0.4 seconds, 0.5 seconds, 0.6 seconds, etc. And the dark color is just a power spectrum. So just you can see the mode that is excited. And it's around 300 hertz. This is Newtonian. I think, in fact, for general relativity, it'll be closer to 500 hertz. And that'll actually make the mechanism that much more, well, I don't want to use the word robust, so I didn't. What you'll get, though, is in these calculations, about 300 hertz oscillation periods of the L equals 1 modes. You get harmonics as well of the fundamental mode, and you'll also get L equals 2 modes, and this doesn't show those. We get in a number of calculations a number of L equals 2 modes. This is stellar pulsation theory. This is from Uno et al. This is like helioseismology. There's a lot of literature on this sort of thing. But we see the frequencies peak and then decay, and you can actually see this in the work of Pons and Morales, where they do protoneutron star cooling calculations and just do a linear stability analysis. When you have the cooling in there, which is important here because it's not P modes, it's not simple pressure waves, it's not sound waves. These are G modes where the restoring force is buoyancy. Buoyancy requires entropy profiles, YE profiles, so you have to do the thermodynamics. It's not just sound travel time, and it isn't sound travel time. Sound travel time will give you millisecond and sub-millisecond periods. So it's the G modes that are probably excited, but it peaks and then decays also in those studies. And we see this generically. No. Yeah, I'll get to that. Yeah, I'll get to that. So that's at L equals 1. Now this is a calculation where we're able to carry it out where the core oscillation grew, saturated, and decayed. A lot of the calculations haven't yet decayed, even after 1.5 seconds, which is rather amazing. But you notice the kinetic energy in here, the maximum kinetic energy, which is the pulsation energy, is about 10 to the 50 ergs in this low-mass progenitor star. That means that the explosion energy is also going to be low, and that's what we see. It's a few times 10 to the 50 ergs for these low mass cases. For the higher mass cases, we see that this peak actually gets to 10 to the 51 ergs. And if the predominant loss mechanism is acoustic power, and it has all the time in the world to do that, barring the neutrinos, then you get 10 to the 51 ergs in the explosions, and we get it naturally. Unfortunately, there's a lot to do in this, and so this is just preliminary set of calculations, but I wanted to show an increase and a decrease. Excuse me? That was ergs in the core. And then it's going to have to decay away, and there's going to be an ergs per second at which it does that. In this particular case, it's sound. Sound. No, it goes at the same rate. It goes at the same, because all you have is the accretion, and that is determined by the progenitor density profile. And it's Sure. Yeah. And that's one thing that that people should keep in mind, that with the Newtonian calculations, I think that the explosion actually happens later than it will for the real general relativistic case. In general relativity, the frequencies are going to be significantly larger, as they say, for the core pulsation. And the power that is pumped in goes to the square of the frequencies. And so we can get a factor of 3 or 4 higher in general relativity, I think, than we get in the Newtonian case. You don't get much more energy, but you'll get more power. And so the thing will happen earlier, and the accretion will be, and you'll truncate the growth of the neutron star that much earlier. That remains to be seen. That's at the level of speculation at this stage. What we're focusing on is the Newtonian results. So let me transition now to the first movie. This is just the inner 100 kilometers, and this is the inner core. This is turbulence on the outside. And here's the clock. That's 400 milliseconds. It's going to 500 milliseconds. And you see the excitation of this core G mode. In order to simulate this, you have to let all the inner core move, because what the oscillation is like this. The center of mass is staying fixed. You have to be able to let the inner material completely move in 2D. You can't do anything in 1D. You can see that it gets fairly vigorous. This region is shrinking in as it cools off. And that's an L equals 1 mode. You can also excite L equals 2 modes. There's a lot happening on the outside too, but this is the type of thing we're getting. And it's damping by acoustic power. It's heat. It's heat. Yeah. That's the sound coming from your mouth is propagating to me. It continues to propagate if I get far enough away, which is my tendency right now. that generates heat in the air, and that's what's happening here. But it's much more dramatic here because you have a steep density gradient, and so that sound wave steepens into shock waves, and so you enterprise the material pretty fast. And then you do this every 3 milliseconds. Okay. Another way of looking at this is this. Now the oscillations are going to be in this direction. That's the axis. These are just ISO density contours colored by density. And you'll just see the core oscillate as well. It's just maybe a little bit clearer. Again, it takes a fairly long time to get going on this. You notice 200 milliseconds already, and it hasn't gotten anything. It takes 500, 600 milliseconds to really get vigorous in these calculations. Exactly what the proper times are, I don't know. But you see this oscillation, and watch the outer material and out of phase with the inner material. That's a G mode. L equals 1 G mode. You can't get them to go together. There is some, yes, and that's all included. In the calculations. We have a whole paper on proto-neutron star convection by Desart et al. The convection is irrelevant for the G mode. We can get G modes on the outside, etc., but this is a core G mode oscillation. We've done it analytically, and we get exactly the same shape. I have a movie at the end of this, which I will not show to anyone but you, and because I don't have the time, but you can compare this with that analytic movie where we've done the eigenfunctions and we've calculated the frequencies, the nodes at 6 to 8 kilometers, exactly the same thing. And we have, in the paper, we have done the modal analysis and we identify the mode. Now this compares the powers in 10 to the 50 ergs per second units. This is 10 to the 52 ergs per second, 10 to the 53 ergs per second, 10 to the 51 ergs per second. This is the accretion power. It's decaying away versus time. This is the gain, the net energy deposited in the gain region behind the shock by neutrinos. And you can see it's significant over here, but it's decaying away. This is our estimate of the acoustic power in this calculation. It's hard to estimate, and you'll see in the hydro in the other movies why that's the case. But you see it crosses. It takes a while to do that in these calculations, but it crosses over. And so after a while, the neutrino energy deposition is swamped by the acoustic power. Now, whether it explodes depends on subsequent evolution, but the accretion is continuing to decay. And as I say, we get explosions for all cases. We can get explosions. We've had stuff go out to 6,000 kilometers, and we find that, in fact, the core is still oscillating. The energy still has to be pumped in. We need more seconds, in fact, to do these calculations. So this is a little bit larger scale, 750 kilometers on the side, and the color is entropy. So it's going to be dull in here in the beginning. These are velocity vectors. Here's the shock is stalled. You get the inner convection here. There's advection through there. It's a large scale. This is only 100 milliseconds, so it's a standard thing. The radius has gotten out a little bit. But notice at 200 kilometers, 250 kilometers, you're going to start seeing the SASE. In fact, you're starting to see this here. Now, notice a few things. It gets so vigorous and nonlinear that you see the shock interactions. The shock, one can call them triple points if you like, but it's really shock interactions there, and it's through this shock, the kinks in the shock structures, that you get this significant accretion. So you see these streams that are coming in, that's significant accretion there. You see the colors are now changing because the entropies are getting larger, and you're starting to get this core to oscillate, and that oscillation is generating sound as well. And even though that's doing that, it hasn't exploded yet, but it's starting to get pretty vigorous. The accretion stream's still coming in, and now it's starting to blow up. Accretion rate, generically it's going to go between, at this stage, 0.1 solar masses a second, a few times 0.1 solar masses a second, and a few times 10 to the minus 2 solar masses a second, depending on the progenitor. For the more massive ones, it's larger. Now this shows the two side by side, where this is the inner core at 50 kilometers. You've seen something like this already, and you'll see the core oscillation. This is the same thing, and you'll see the core oscillation in those iso-density contours there eventually, but this is on 200 kilometer time scales, and you can start seeing the explosion phase here when this is going. So these are simultaneous in phase. So when this is happening, this is happening. Now we're going to see L equals 2 modes in here too. If you know how to see these vorticities, multiple vorticities, you can check this. This is getting pretty vigorous. And you can see the corresponding motion of the isodensity contour here. Still hasn't exploded. This is a 25 solar mass, a model of 25 solar mass. This is L equals 2. That gives a lot of gravitational radiation. But with all this large accretion, it doesn't explode for a while. It gets really vigorous and has to pump up this thing a lot. But eventually it does. This is 900 milliseconds after bounce. Now you see that oscillation and that oscillation. This thing's exploding now. It's in the key of F. Okay. Moving right along, there are lots of reasons one wouldn't have seen this before. The major thing is that people didn't include 2D motions of the core. It's also the case you have to worry about momentum conservation. We have a Cartesian-like grid that transitions to a spherical grid rather uniquely. We had to worry about gravity in this context. You need, when the core is oscillating like this, to be able to do really higher order moments. So we have a Poisson solver in there, but you also we found we need a moving grid in order to maintain the resolution. And we worried about this a lot. And I think that we've overcome our fundamental worries about the about these approaches. And this is uniquely capable. We can uniquely do this in Vulcan. Very quickly, we've done some accretion disk collapse. This is a very rapidly rotating model. I'll leave to the gamma ray burst people, the people that are interested, whether they see anything in here that collapses. But there's significant rotation. It almost explodes almost immediately. We start out with a rotating object. This is using initial models of Yoon and Langer. We form an accretion disk. Naturally, the neutrinos are on. The neutrino sphere is actually very, very oblate. This is looking peculiar. These are isodensity contours. This is going to clean out a bit. You see the wind coming off the surface, coming off from this very inner region. The scale here is about a few thousand kilometers. See this coming off? Now, it's actually more wide angle than this. This is where the high entropies and YU.5 are. It settles down, and it just goes steady, and you get an explosion that's a multiple 10 to the 50 ergs. This is after 740 milliseconds. And you can see the basic shapes. You get a bipolar jet. The core oscillation did not happen, did not occur. This is the inner region and the emission off the surface. This is a neutrino-driven wind that is asymmetrical and is naturally generated without any artifice. Obvious artifice. Gravitational radiation, I'm going to go quickly because my time is short and you may have some questions. One of the polarizations versus time, you could just look at the gravitational strain. When the SASE starts, you get this, and L equals 2 mode goes like this, and we can actually get significant amount of emission. At least, even without rotation, you've broken the symmetry, and that's crucial here, and there are all sorts of, nature will break its symmetries. Once you've done that and go through phases like this, if this indeed obtains, then if you get any L equals 2 character, that'll generate gravitational radiation. The frequencies are 600 to 1,000 hertz. The frequencies are very pure. The widths might be only 50 hertz. It makes the signal-to-noise analysis in a LIGO or a Virgo or something like this much easier. And the strongest signal that we've gotten, and I don't want to push this too hard because it may not be generic, the strongest signal we've gotten goes out to a megaparsec in the second-generation LIGO. I think the salient features, which I've listed here, are pretty clear, but perhaps in the question period, people can delve into this more. I've summarized them. I won't repeat. There are a lot of new things here. It may or may not be true. If the neutrino mechanism doesn't work, it's hard to suppress this as far as we can tell. If it does work, it would have to work in the first few milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds, I think, but it's not clear. It may be well that the, as Janka has emphasized, it may be that the SASE plus the neutrinos, perhaps even for the more massive progenitors, for which it doesn't seem to really work together, but it works together to give you some neutrino-driven explosion. And that hasn't been tested, for, at least published, for a full 180 degrees. We don't see that. But with better physics, we might get something like that. But the indications are, at least our current thinking, is that the acoustic mechanism is something that's very interesting, and it might actually be an important component of supernova theory, and maybe a crucial component of supernova theory that had been hitherto suppressed and missed. Thank you very much for your patience.
Okay, thank you, Adam. Do we have questions? Dr. Young?
Adam, this plot which you showed about the gravitational wave emission for the 25 solar mass star, was that a rotating model?
No.
Why did it have a signal at core bounce?
The core bounce, I think, is some of that is an artifact of the gridding. And we've done higher resolution and it goes away a bit. With rotation, we get almost exactly that, and that's a coincidence. Yeah, I think that's the case. It's a resolution thing, and we can get around that. The signal after that was so much larger that it's just in the noise. But it's a good point.
I was struck earlier in the week in Blondin's beautiful talk by the fact that at the onset of his instability, accretion shock instability, the rise time for the into the nonlinear sector was very slow. There were lots of oscillations before you went nonlinear. Now that is rather reminiscent of the situation in the, as you recall, in the gravitational wave instabilities of the rapidly rotating neutron stars, where under very similar conditions of temperature, it turned out to be damped by viscosity. So before you tell me there's no viscosity, I want to ask whether you've considered the same source of viscosity as in that well-explored case, namely the lag in equilibration of electron number when you do
sure. Now, in what Blondin has done, he didn't include neutrinos. He had a four-thirds gas. It was an artificial initial model, and he cut out the core. Okay. Now, when we put all that stuff back in there, we still get the SASE to go, and more or less develop a similar along the lines that that have been suggested, with a period of about 30 milliseconds, etc. But the most important physics is in a region where the viscosity, and more importantly said in general, the dissipation is rather small.
My question was, have you considered this bulk viscosity?
Bulk viscosity is in the calculation.
Right.
Yeah, but it's not just bulk viscosity. We have to worry about the dissipation due to the fact that you're generating in the core. The outer instability is a different instability. The SASE is different. The inner core oscillation is the crucial thing in our regard. And that's 10 times shorter period, gives off a lot more acoustic power, and is the agency of explosion in our calculations when the SASE is not. SASE sets the stage. The SASE happens in an optically thin region, but in the core, I'll answer a question fairly similar to the one you asked, which is that you have to worry about all the dissipation processes. And in particular, if you have sound moving through a region, which is, this isn't really sound, but you'll have temperature gradients that are produced on those periods. And those temperature gradients will give you the dissipation. The bulk viscosity is not as important as those. So you have temperature gradients and YE gradients that are imposed, and that'll give you the dissipation, just like sound in the atmosphere. And the magnitude of that depends on the details, which are also included in the calculations, but I want to do a little bit more resolution studies, et cetera, to see what the magnitude is. And you worry about numerical dissipation. But it doesn't seem as though it's causing any damping, and the calculation has that in there. It doesn't have in there the proper way of handling the shear viscosity. But it does have the bulk viscous effects, and it does have the lowest order effects due to the imposition of gradients in all the composition variables due to the oscillation, which is the most crucial thing. So I think that's handled pretty well. But your point's well taken. There's a whole literature in the neutron stars, as you're well aware, about the effect. And the bulk viscous effect in this context would be on 10-second timescales. We were interested in a few seconds. Kurt.
So
you don't need to, people are confused by that. You don't need to have the same frequency. All you need to do is pour water in the lake. You have accretion streams that have no periodicity at all, although early on the turbulence actually has a frequency spectrum, and that's exciting the mode initially. But you just pour water on a lake, it produces ripples, and those ripples will propagate over the surface. And they don't have any periodicity at all, but the waves do. Thickness of the accretion column, etc. And those, in this case, the lake is spherical, and the waves go to the back, and then they come to the front, and you're pumping up the modes that are there, and the whole frequency, the whole spectrum. That even just with a simple stream of water hitting the surface, and that's confused a lot of people. We don't have to have anything at 3 milliseconds.
But the waves in the lake,
yeah, they do. They would if this happened. You just don't have big enough lakes, and you don't have spherical lakes. We have spherical lakes, and we have a hell of a downpour.
Dr. Nomura, a question?
Yeah, two questions. You mentioned mass dependence. So the
progenitor dependence.
Is it due to the mass of the collapsing core and the mass accretion rate dependence? That is one question. The second is the other process things. The case of the AIC, accretion is induced collapse, the entropy is also high enough to make our process? Or?
Curiously, no. Not in our calculations. The accretion-induced collapse has low entropies. It explodes too early, and we don't get this core oscillation effect. It's just the neutrino heating, and that doesn't give it high enough numbers. But we do get high enough numbers for the R process beyond 300, the entropies of 300 with these models. And we don't know the end of it because the calculations haven't ended, even after 1.5 seconds in the Newtonian calculations. As far as the mass of the neutron stars, the mass of the neutron star is going to be given by the accretion rate versus time. It depends completely on the progenitor and then when you explode and stop the accretion. This is happening late enough that we're accumulating for the lowest mass progenitors 1.46 solar masses, this sort of thing. But then we're getting 1.7 baryonic. We can get 1.9 solar masses baryonic. I think those are too high. However, if you can get it to happen earlier, and everything that we're looking at seems to be impeding it early. So if we liberate it and make it as close to nature, I think that the thing will happen earlier. You, in fact, will get something fairly close, I believe, to the masses that nature provides. But that is an issue, but it's all coupled. And I think general relativity is going to make that difference.
Two quick questions.
We have time for more than two, I think, but go on.
No, just, okay, first, do you see any potential for this mechanism to explain neutrons?
Potential for the mechanism?
Do you see potential for this mechanism to explain neutron star kicks? And then second, is there any potential, can this mechanism have any imprint on the ejecta that might be seen in the form of the supernova remnants later on?
Yeah, the morphology is always going to be asymmetric. You can't get it to be spherical. Generically, most of the time we get unipolar explosions, mostly on one direction than another, but it has to eventually explode in all directions. But it starts out in one direction much more, and that takes a fair amount of seconds. I think that the heavy elements are going to be very asymmetrical, and the lighter elements are going to be more symmetrical.
Oh, first Vikram.
Okay.
Adam, I was wondering.
There was more to his question, but go on. Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm listening.
How much of all this mechanism? How much does it depend on the density and the structure of the outer envelope and, you know, the whole mechanism? And
the mechanism itself, or the viability of the mechanism, doesn't seem to depend on it. The numbers depend crucially on it. And so if you have a density profile that drops off fast, this happens earlier and more weakly. If it drops out slowly, it takes longer, but then you get a higher energy explosion. We get that the lowest mass progenitors have low explosion energies, and the higher mass progenitors have the highest explosion energies, and we span about an order of magnitude.
So suppose you go to Wolf-Rayet stars with, envelopes, they've lost their hydrogen helium envelopes, they have sort of compact envelopes.
Well, those envelopes, that part of the envelope is pretty far out. I'm talking about the inner 5,000 kilometers, not 20,000, 30,000, 100,000 kilometers.
Okay, but that would eventually make a difference to the explosion. Like his question was whether the asymmetry is how what you would see in the...
Right, and that's why I said the asymmetry is going to depend on the shell. The inner shells are going to be very asymmetric and going to be unipolar mostly. We get explosions that are a little bit more quadrupolar at times. And it depends on when things explode and the 2D nature of it. To some degree. I think in 3D it's not going to be qualitatively different, but that remains to be seen.
And just one more quick
question. So the morphology is going to be interesting.
Just one quick question. What's the highest energy you can get from all this?
Like, I don't know. I don't think we can get hypernovae, at least really hypernovae out of this. But if it's 10 to 52 ergs, it might be tough. But it's tough for all mechanisms to get close to that. I think that, in fact, those are MHD processes. We can get 10 to 51, I believe. But the cute thing about this is that it takes a long time to actually deposit all that energy. At the end of some of these calculations, we're depositing energy at 10 to 51 ergs a second. That means we have to wait a second to get all that deposited. That's a long time, and longer than we thought the neutrino mechanism required. So it's a different regime. They're all radiation dominated. They're all asymmetrical. They all take a long time. And yes, we think we can get kicks.
One last question from Norbert.
We've seen earlier in talks that the SASSY modified accretion streams can spin up the neutron star. So does that happen to you? And
I can't see that because it's axially symmetric calculations.
Oh, I see.
So then we can't get non-axis symmetric torques.
Could it happen that the pulsations are modified by rotation and that, you know, you get mode splitting and maybe the amplitudes don't get so high anymore?
That I'm not so sure about. I think that it will change. I mean, we get M equals 0, L equals 1, 2, 3, etc. And you're going to get these other modes as well. You break the symmetry and you start going in one particular direction, it runs away in that direction. And I think that in 3D it's going to do something similar. But 3D is going to be interesting, and so that's another shoe to drop. But it's hard to see how you would suppress this. The question is what amplitude you reach and whether you've exploded earlier. If you exploded earlier, much of this is moot.
I was very interested by those simulations you showed of accretion-induced collapse. Observationally, what would that look like?
Good question. We really want to get this firmed up, but unfortunately, we haven't gotten to it. Let me give you a very qualitative answer. These things don't have any envelope. The nickel yields are going to be pretty small. The mass that you're ejecting is pretty small. You're leaving behind a lot of big accretion disks. We have not included MHD processes, so that aside, it seems as though it would be a really fast supernova that will last a day or less. You produce very little nickel, and it's not clear that we've seen anything like this. It would be a transient. In gamma rays, X-rays, and optical. Radio perhaps as well, but that I don't have a competent position on.
Adam, when you say the explosion happens late and it's all dominated by radiation, how much nickel do you produce?
That seems the curious and I think very interesting part of this is that the ejecta mass is fairly small. And so what you have is a radiation-dominated bubble that then produces nickel in the oxygen zone on the outside at Yu sub 0.5. And you don't have any real problem with the any anomalous Ye ejecta in the inside, even though people have shown that at least in spherical symmetry, you can get reasonable Yes with a good neutrino transfer. We don't have that problem for even another reason, which is we don't eject much mass from the inner region. The blast is just starting to go through the outer region, and that's where the nickel is going to be produced. And so we don't know what the numbers are yet because we have to blast out to 20,000 kilometers and get the whole thing to happen. And it will reveal itself, at least in the context of this mechanism, but I can't give you a really good number. But it's just like a thermal bomb at really high entropies at a reasonable radius going through an oxygen zone.
Thank you very much. Let's thank Adam again. All right, for the next talk in the